Think big. Think positive. Never show any sign of weakness. Always go for the throat. Buy low, sell high. Fear, that's the other guy's problem. Nothing you have ever experienced can prepare you for the unbridled carnage you're about to witness. Right. Super Bowl, the World Series, they don't know what pressure is. In this building, it's either kill or be killed. Right. You make no friends in the pits and you take no prisoners.
No prisoners.
1 minute, you're up half a million in soybeans, and the next, boom, your kids don't go to college and they've repossessed your Bentley. Are you with me?
Turner's Take Podcast. I'm your host, Craig Turner, author of the Turner's Take newsletter. You can find me at turnerstake.com, and if you're a farmer, turnerstakeag.com. I'm also a broker here at Daniels Trading. We work with broker-assisted clients. We have a fantastic online trading platform for the computer and also your phone. And then we have hybrid, which is one of our most popular service levels, which is a mix of both. So if you have any questions, you want to work with us, I do a lot of hedge business, and we also do a lot of speculative trading here, so feel free to contact us anytime. So let's get into it. This is going to be a relatively short podcast. Today's Wednesday is the only day of the week I'm in the office this week. Monday was closed for MLK, and I talked with at a conference yesterday put on by Ag Risk Managers, which is located up in the northwestern part of Wisconsin. They did a fantastic job, just top-notch outfit over there, and they do a lot of in crop insurance. And if you're in that part neck of the woods and you need crop insurance, I got to tell you, I was really impressed. You should check those guys out. So tomorrow I'm going to be – so I'm back in Chicago today, and then tonight I'm flying out. I'm going out to Denver for Farmland Partners, which is a company listed on New York Stock Exchange. They own over 100,000 acres of farmland, and that farmland is then rented out. They actually do a very good job. I saw them last year. I was very impressed. They get the farmers that rent land from them some really pretty good deals. You know, because it's such a large organization. You know, I think they're able to buy like seed and chemicals and other services in bulk and pass those savings along to any of the farmers that rent their land. And they have some high quality land, you know, through Iowa and Illinois and out, you know, throughout the Midwest, down in the Southeast and Colorado. And it's not just corn, wheat, and soybeans they're doing, but I know their tenants also grow other crops. So I've always been very impressed by them too. So I will be out there speaking at their conference. And that conference is Thursday and Friday. So today is, long story short, today's the only day I'm in the office, so we're going to do this podcast here. I'm not going to get into the outside market so much today. We're going to save that for next week. I will say, okay, but I will quickly hit on it. We had been talking about cocoa, and it looking for a move lower, and I think it's made it. And honestly, at this point, I'd be just looking to, you know, probably just take what the market gave us and leave. I also kind of say that just because I'm not going to be in the office a whole lot, right? And when you're up on something like that, you just want to get out. I think natural gas has come back down to a level here that looks could be a buy again. We've filled the gap again on natural gas, and I think that looks interesting. And if I was writing my spec newsletter this week, which unfortunately I'm not, just because all the travel, we'd probably be looking to get into natural gas again. Which you're more than welcome to, you know, if you are self-directed or do you want to call in and talk to a broker or talk to me today about it. Crude, I still see is range-bound. It looks like the latest economic reports are just showing we will have modest growth. We're probably late cycle in the U.S. cycle, which means we could expect maybe a little bit of a recession at the end of the year in 2020. But for now, the slower growth we have is typically what's known as a late session, you know, late cycle economy. And if that's the case, then I think crude is range bound. We'll have some supply coming in, we'll have some demand coming in, and we're going to be in that range. I still like straddles, or, you know, selling call spreads and put spreads in that, you know, that is something I wrote about last week, and I still like that. I still like those trades. If anything, I'd want to be bullish on crude on the dips, I think, as we go into the low 50s or high 40s. It's because you never know when the economy is going to start picking up again, and you never know when there's conflict in the Middle East. So that's my view, and also quite honestly, if you look at a chart of crude, I mean, we had been in the 30s during extremes, but, you know, the big range seems to be this, you know, mid to high 40s to the 70s. And if we're in the low 50s, high 40s, that, you know, without some kind of huge supply shock to the system or demand, you know, crushing development, that will most likely be the range. So that's why I kind of view crude that way. Cover the softs. The stock market I'm not going to get into today. There's not a whole lot of fresh news in there. And also with the government shutdown, we'll talk about that for a minute. The government shutdown still going to go on. There has been talks now from both sides about easing their demands. We first saw it from the president, and now we're starting to see it on the Democrat side too. So that's been encouraging. That's been very encouraging, actually. So we definitely like to see that. So we'll see what they say. There's now talk about funding for the wall, but maybe not, you know, it being a smart wall instead of like a physical wall. And, you know, now the president's saying, well, if we get the wall, maybe we can do green cards for the Dreamers. So you can see it all coming back. And quite honestly, I think what people are saying, and the conference I was at yesterday, one of the big economists that were there was saying that if we get to a situation where, like, something like food stamps is affected, like funding runs out for something big that really hurts a lot of people, and not saying that isn't already, because you are reading about the people who work for the government who aren't going to paycheck, but if it gets into food stamps, people outside of the government, right, then there could be so much political pressure coming in, something eventually gets done. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes. And when the government does open up, I want to get out of our grain straddle, so let's switch over to the grains for a moment. We have been in old crop corn straddles, short straddles, collecting premium on grain and storage, which I like. But once we start to think the government's going to open back up, I really do want to get out of those and take. We're up now on them, but we're going to let the value erode a little bit. But once we start thinking that we are getting closer to government reopen, we want to get out of those and even be probably a little bit long. I think when the market data comes out, we're going to see probably this corn crop get a little bit smaller, and we're going to see a lot of exports as corn is very competitively priced. So I do have a natural medium to long-term bullish outlook on corn. In the short term, I just think it's choppy, and it's going to be that way until we get some more data from the government. I think wheat's the same way too. We saw stories about Russian wheat stocks. You know, where they're probably lower than people expected in some of the reports that came out. We saw 2017 stocks that were released today. I guess Russia's pretty slow on releasing that kind of data, and they were lower than expected. And we're seeing interior wheat prices in Russia being reported at, you know, continue to make highs for the year. So we should see more U.S. exports. We probably are. And then when you go to the China-U.S. talks, you know, there has been talk of China, you know, buying more grain. Every once in a while, they go out, we hear stories of them going to the cash market, just checking on prices for wheat, checking on prices for corn, checking on prices for soybeans. And, you know, you kind of get the United States will be talking with China again next week. They're hoping talks will go well. China's going to probably buy some more grain from us. And with the latest story of them really, you know, trying to buy $1 trillion of grain between now and the next 4 or 5 years to help even out the trade balance, I understand why they're doing that. They're trying to get the U.S. to bite on that and not have to confront the intellectual property issues. But I think that's going to be a non-starter. I think the administration's really going to dig on that. And that's how we're going to finish up this podcast, just on that story. So I just want to go through a couple things first before I get there. Just a quick market deal. Informa came out with their estimates for acres. And I want to say it was like 96 and change for soybeans. And I actually kind of thought we'd be at, I'm sorry, 86 and change for soybeans. And I kind of thought it'd be at around 87. And they had 91 and change, like 91 and a half for corn. I thought it'd be close to 91. So I think we're all in the same, in the same thought process. What's really interesting is in November and December, when you're putting pen to pencil and you're just doing the math, right? Just doing the economics of the math of taking average costs and, you know, per acre and where prices were going to be in just purely from, you know, not taking into effect basis or credit or how certain parts of the country do, but just, you know, taking the national average and writing out the math, you could have made an argument for like 85 million acres soybeans and 93 million acres corn. The thing is, a couple of things has kind of reduced that view in my mind. Now, this isn't from foreign, this is me doing my own work on it. In Illinois and Iowa, guys who rent land can't make soybeans work at 350 to 400 an acre on rented land. It's just very difficult to make soybeans work. And you know, the guys who own land will do their normal rotation. I'm sure the guys who rent land will also do some soybeans, will probably switch to more corn, which is originally what we were kind of thought the trend would be. But when you get outside of that area that has just those incredible yields, you know, potential, and you talk to farmers, like in the Dakotas or out west of the Mississippi, well west of the Mississippi, down south, and one thing they keep on saying is just how high the input costs are for corn. And then in their mind, it's more of like, well, I'll just plant soybeans because it costs less, and we'll just see how things go with China and see how the yields go. So then that started us making us think, okay, maybe we're not going to see as many corn acres as the expense to soybeans. And then the third piece of the puzzle has been harvest was so late this year, a lot of field work just didn't get done in the fall. And a lot of, you know, and to prepare for corn and to get that field work done, now it's going to be done in the spring. And if we get a late start to the spring, if it's cold, if it's wet, or if there's just too much to do, that could come at the expense of corn acres too. So instead of being like 85 to 83 beans, like we thought might be possible a couple of months ago, with like 93 or more in corn, I really wouldn't be surprised if wheat holds steady, right? We lose winter wheat acres, but we gain in spring wheat and some of the other wheat, and wheat kind of stays the same. And then we gain 2 million in corn, we lose 2 million in beans, we're at 87. We're at 87 basically soybeans, 91 corn, bearish, kind of unfortunately bearish for beans, surprisingly bullish for corn. Because when you do a 91 million acres and just a trend line yield, I'm going to have to go through my numbers again, and I will for next week. I've just been too busy to this week. But we're going to be still in this, we're going to be under 2 billion carryout, and with expected demand and any kind of issues with South American weather, you know, we could be flirting with 1.5 again, you know, on any kind of hiccups, which suggests to me new crop corn could be well into the fours, and old crop can even make a run at four at that point. So I'm going to need to do more of my homework on that, and I'm going to have some, going to do it over the weekend, and in the beginning of next week, we're going to really hammer down on where we think we could go. But I'm excited to be out in Denver and talk to some farmers from all over the country and what they're hearing, and between the wheat story that's going on right now internationally and how things are shaping up for corn, I'm having much more of a bias of in the medium to long term bullish, in the medium term bullish, short and medium term bullish wheat. Unfortunately, in the back end, a little bit bearish because the rest of the world will have better production in the next 3 to 6 months. Choppy now for corn until the government opens back up in China deal, and then I'm much more bullish on corn. So we'll hold our short straddles for now when we think the government's going to reopen, take profits on those straddles, and start looking for ways to get long. Or look for sales, depending on if you're a spec or a hedge. And then for soybeans, I think we're going to have to use any kind of... We'll see what happens with the Chinese deal. And whenever that enthusiasm runs out, you know, if you're look for ways to sell it. Because the picture that I'm seeing right now is not pretty, and we'll get more into that too. So that's where we're seeing things. I will be in Denver tomorrow and Friday, and I'll be back in the office on Monday. Last thing I'm going to leave you with here is just something to think about this trade deal. And there's a lot of reports last week about China offering $1 trillion, you know, over the course between now 2024, and that'll eventually close the gap of a massive, you know, the trade gap that we've been talking about forever in terms of how much China buys from us and how much we buy them. And they would make that number up by basically buying stuff that they need, the ag and energy and some of the manufacturing products from us, which I don't think would be a huge leap for them. They already buy a lot of ag and energy, and ag and energy from us wouldn't be really that much more expensive than from other places around the world, and it kind of seems like a win-win for them. And they come out with this big number, and it could be a win for everyone, especially in the short term. It's a win for China to get things going again. That'd be a win for all the politicians here to make them look good. Be a win for farmers, it'd be a win for manufacturing, it'd be a win for the energy markets. Here is the thing. In the long term, it's a lose for the United States, and it's a win for China. And this is why. And I don't want to get this deep into the weeds. I've talked about it before, but there is something in economics called total factor productivity. And don't fall asleep on me yet, but it's called total factor productivity. All right, I'm going way back here to my days at Goldman and when I was getting my MBA at NYU, Stern School of Business. And what that is, total factor productivity, is basically a way economists, and this is really at the, bear with me on this is really at the crux, I think, of the trade deal and why this is such a big deal between the United States and China and why it's gone on like this. That calculation is basically a way for economists to say, okay, you get economic growth by inputs. There's like what's known as input economic growth for a nation, and that's like investments, capital expenditures, getting your population educated, saving, getting rid of debt, and you know these, and you know maybe getting your the resources and labor more organized, right? And then there's that accounts for a certain amount of economic growth. Whatever is left over, but kind of like with the USDA report with residual, right? Whatever is left over is basically what, you know, how innovative you are, what kind of technology and productivity you're creating out of the economy instead of just like putting in inputs, right? So here's the deal. Like for countries that go from developing nations to developed nations, if they don't have a system in place that basically allows for innovation, profit motive, capitalism, creating technology and efficiencies, developing countries can only go so far. Like they can grow at a very fast rate as they get their population more educated, as they increase the savings rate, as you know, they go from a farming, agricultural background to maybe manufacturing. And that is what has really happened in China and why they had this huge growth rate. And now things are slowing down. And the only way for China to really go far, keep on going, is to have basically technology and innovation to help them with efficiencies and growth of wealth. I mean, I've seen economists, when I was in school, some economists would say much of the wealth creation in the United States since, you know, 1776 or 1787, wherever you want to start, 80% of that can be explained in basically improvements in technology. But you can only get that if you have the big profit motive, if you have a capitalist society where you are encouraging people to take risk, business risk, investment risk, to make that happen. China's a communist country. I mean, there's probably someone on a board over there that regulates the price of bread. You know, it's very different than it is over here. So for them to get that growth, for them to not have stunted growth, they either have to change their political system, open up the economies, or find a way to, let's say, for lack of, you know, import technology and innovation, which is what they do now. Like, they, you know, the whole thing with China is they are trying to get as much their hands on technology and innovation from outside, and that's why everything is a joint venture. That's why that's why they're more prone to borrow other people's technologies, right? You know, a nice way to put it. But that's really what's going on. If that gets shut off, the growth rate in China really starts to come to a halt, and then you have some very tough positions for the Chinese, like to go from a communist party to an open, you know, to an open free market party. Think about all the political leaders who have jobs controlling labor, markets, you know, I mean, really everything in life, you know, over there, to then letting it go to a free market. You know, you're probably, I mean, you think the, I mean, some people think the government in the United States is big. You know, imagine what it is in China, right? And then what would happen if they, you know, probably lose, half the Communist Party would lose their jobs or lose their function. So they're, you know, in society over there. So that's it's a harder sell than it is. And even if China, now I can see them maybe taking steps to opening up the economy, taking steps to kind of have setting up a system economic and political, to encourage economic and basically technology growth. Because without it, they don't. Now, what's interesting is I think the United States for years has kind of let China get by because they weren't a huge threat. They're kind of looked at as, you know, the pesky little brother. But the thing is now, China really is the number one competitor to national security, you know, and world influence, economic, military, everything, right? China's the new Russia, or whatever, however you want to put it. So they're not going to let them take the technology, because I'm sure that all the economists and all the guys in the White House that you don't hear about on CNBC, but, you know, set this kind of policy, basically say, if China can't come up with their own technology, can't come up with their own efficiencies, they'll stop growing. And if they don't have the money and they don't have the growth, they're no longer a threat to national security, they're no longer a threat to the United States, to be a real competitor to the United States for basically global influence and power. So make no mistake about it. That is what's really at the crux going on, I think. And, you know, and we can talk, you know, and China is going to try to buy their way out of it. And if the administration really sticks to their guns and looks at this as a national security level on par with the Cold War, they will go down fighting till the very end about this intellectual technology, or at least I think where the compromise happens is they get China on a pathway to be less dependent on other people's technologies and more innovation. It's, you know, and I can see that if China starts talking about the need to open up the economy, the need to have their own technology innovation organically and changing the economic and political system just slowly to do that, you know, to get them down that road, that could be enough then to get this whole deal done. So I really think that's how it goes. I can't see it going any other way. Again, didn't mean to put everyone to sleep there, but if you want to read more about it, total factor productivity, and there's some great studies on it, on what eventually happened to the Soviet Union, and explains the fall of the Soviet Union. It also explains the crash in Southeast Asia that we had in the late 90s. And it was the same deal, you know, something like with Russia, like, you know, during, you know, many people don't remember this, but I think it's Khrushchev, who was the premier of Russia. You know, there's that famous footage of him in the 50s, you know, saying on, you know, television with his shoe hitting the podium, saying, "We're going to crush you." You know, I don't know if you've seen those old clips. And what's interesting is they're not talking about it, you know, military, you know, or the hockey team's going to beat us. They are talking about at that communist convention when he's up there saying we'll crush you. He's talking about economic growth. I don't think what people really realize or remember is that, you know, after World War II, U.S. growth was fantastic, right? In the 50s and 60s after the World War, the economy came out of the Great Depression and it was sweet times. You know, Russia and the Soviet Union had a double our growth rate for the most part through the 50s and 60s during our heyday. And it freaked out a lot of economists and politicians and didn't understand why the Soviet Union was growing and this model of economic development. But what they were doing was basically manual inputs. They were taking the whole entire basically agrarian workforce and making them into factories. They were educating everyone, you know, where they didn't have much of an education, then everyone got educated into, you know, up to high school. They were making significant investments. And the problem is, if you don't have the profit motive, you don't have the motive for the population to be innovators in technology, eventually that growth just stalls. And that's what happened to the Soviet Union in the 70s and 80s. That's why it went bankrupt. So China, in some way, sees the writing on the wall. They're not going to be as worse off as Russia is, because China has kind of gone quasi-capitalism. But for them, and that has been good, and that'll be fine, so they won't crash. You know, they won't crash like the Soviet Union did. But what it won't do is allow them to be a dominant player in the world affairs if they don't have to basically find a way to increase their total factor productivity, and that is through technology, and that is through opening up the economy, and that is becoming more capitalist and an open society. So, and the only way for them to get around that right now is really to borrow or import other people's technology. The United States knows that, and that's why a lot of this stuff, it can be traced back, what's going on between the United States and China now, into national security documents. And a bigger part of the State Department that I think people realize, and it's not just so much Trump just saying we have a bad deal. There's a lot more going on there. So Yeah, I hope you enjoyed that part. If that was just maybe if you like that kind of stuff, I'll happy every once in a while to get more into the things like that with the economy. I always worry that I might be losing people, but that is basically it. So I am off to Denver tonight. I'll be there for 2 days, and then I don't travel again until Commodity Classic, which we are. If you are going to the Commodity Classic, I believe we're booth 1061. Let me double check on that. Yeah, we're 1061. So if you're going to be in the Commodity Classic, which isn't until the end of February or March, that's the next time I travel. Come visit us. I'm going to do a live podcast. So if you're going to be in Orlando during the Commodity Classic, I would love to know. Shoot me an email. Shoot me a message on Twitter. Give me a call if you're a client. It'd be great to meet up with you down there. So otherwise, I'll be out tomorrow and today. Tomorrow and the next day. And then I will be back. So have a great week, everyone. And I will talk to you later. Bye.
This material is conveyed as a solicitation for entering into a derivatives transaction. This material has been prepared by a Daniels trading broker who provides research market commentary and trade recommendations as part of his or her solicitation for accounts and solicitation for trades. Daniels Trading, its principals, brokers, and employees may trade in derivatives for their own accounts or for the accounts of others. Due to various factors such as risk tolerance, margin requirements, trading objectives, short-term versus long-term strategies, technical versus fundamental market analysis, and other factors, such trading may result in the initiation or liquidation of positions that are different from or contrary to the opinions and recommendations contained therein. Past performance is not necessarily indicative of future performance. The risk of loss in trading futures contracts or commodity options can be substantial, and therefore, investors should understand the risks involved in taking leveraged positions and must assume responsibility for the risks associated with such investments and for their results. You should carefully consider whether such trading is suitable for you in light of your circumstances and financial resources. You should read the risk disclosure accessed at www.danielstrading.com. Daniels Trading is not affiliated with, nor does it endorse any trading system, newsletter, or similar service. Daniels Trading does not guarantee or verify any performance claims made by such systems or services.